Okay, intro to logic or critical thinking. So as I mentioned, tonight we'll be stretching our minds a bit. You know, it feels like a classroom setting already. We got some tables set up. I know it's a little cramped, but thank you for bearing with me. And as I mentioned, we're going to go through the what and whys of logic, and we're going to also go through the building blocks and basic logical structures. And if you take a look at your worksheet, you'll see that there'll be examples. So when we get to those examples, I'm going to try to use the dry erase board and we're going to work through them. We're going to determine what are some easy ways to understand some of these examples if they get a little too difficult. But I want to start with the first question here, which is, why is logic important? I gave you a brief glimpse, but let's dig in a little bit more. Why is logic important? Why logic in particular? Why should we concentrate on this? Well, I think it first helps to have a definition of logic before we want to understand why it's important. So I'll give you a brief definition. Logic is a tool or a set of tools that helps us order our thoughts so that we may distinguish between good and bad arguments. Logic is a tool or a set of tools that helps us order our thoughts so that we may distinguish between good and bad arguments. And really, really, guys, it's unavoidable. Everyone thinks logically. The question is, are we thinking correctly? So everyone uses logic. Some of us may use it poorly. Some of us use it correctly. Well, one reason that logic is important, guys, is it helps us in our conversations with others. And really, that's one of our aims here, is to equip the church, our church members here, equip them with the tools, the knowledge set, to be able to go out confidently and share good reasons for why we believe that Christianity is true and why other belief systems or religions are false. So logic is one way that it can help, definitely can help. I would say it's a foundation of helping us to have conversations, confident conversations with others. There's another book I was reading, and the author there, he said, "I don't think it is any exaggeration to say that one of the biggest reasons why so many people don't know how to effectively communicate without losing their friends is because they don't know the basics of logic." I'm sure you guys have heard the saying, you know, around the dinner table or something, you don't want to talk about politics or religion. I heard that so many times growing up. I don't know why. I was just always, what's the big deal? It's like, have wars started over these things? Of course, right? But you don't talk about politics or religion. And I believe one of the reasons that many people default to this line of thinking is really because they're not prepared to think deeply or critically about their own beliefs. You know, we pretty much grew up in our culture. We were nurtured into our beliefs. We talked about worldviews and how a lot of these assumptions are honed in over time. So they're deeply rooted. But the thing is that, you know, you ask a person, why do you believe this? Oh, well, grandma believed this. And, you know, that's just what we do. Grandma says it, I believe it, you know. But we're not prepared, or a lot of us are not prepared to think critically. When somebody comes against us with, well, I don't think that's true, I think you're wrong, we're like, no. But you may be intrigued for a little bit. You're like, go on, I want to hear your thoughts. But as soon as it gets to a point where, oh, I don't think I can handle this conversation anymore, I've been part of conversations and I've seen a lot of conversations that just stop abruptly. Because the moment that person feels uncomfortable, they're like, oh, well, I make it a habit not to talk about politics or religion. That's my own personal thing. So I'm going to stop the conversation right here. That happens a lot. And the reason I think is that there lacks a foundation of correct critical thinking. So that's the first point. Logic helps us in our conversations with others. Also, logic can help us avoid holding false beliefs. Now, this hits home. This hits every single person in here. Logic will help us avoid holding false beliefs. Nobody in here, I think, wants to hold a false belief. Every belief that we have, think of the core beliefs that you think you have. You would say that you have good reasons for those, especially if you hold them very dear to your heart. Well, what if somebody were to let you know your beliefs are false, or some of those core beliefs are false. I think a lot of us would be upset, or it would take a great deal of evidence, at least, for us to think otherwise, to say, yes, I agree it's false, I'm going to change my line of thinking. So nobody in here wants to hold false beliefs. Well, one way to ensure, or at least make it have a better probability of not holding false beliefs, is to have a good foundation of good critical thinking skills, good logical skills. And even you read through the scriptures, and critical thinking, guys, is encouraged all throughout the scriptures. I mean, even in the Old Testament, the Hebrews, the Israelites, were called the people of the word. Their entire culture was surrounded by understanding and studying the Old Testament books. So they had to know what these books were saying. But also in the New Testament, we see it even more and more explicitly. Paul, the Apostle Paul, encouraged the church to test all things and hold fast to that which is true. Test the spirits to see whether or not they are from God. You saw the good Bereans in Acts 17 who, after hearing a sermon, they went back home and they actually looked into the scriptures to determine whether or not the teachings were true. So we're encouraged, guys, to think critically. Even if you look at the Gospels themselves and you see the discussions that Jesus had with the Pharisees or the scribes or the Sadducees, Jesus, in my opinion, was the greatest logician ever. He wasn't a formal, like, PhD professor, but the way he reasoned, you look at the way he just deconstructed those arguments of the Pharisees and the scribes and the Sadducees, it was just with ease, but it was very forceful, very powerful, very persuasive. So you can look at Jesus's discussion. So basically, my main point here is, why is logic important? Well, everyone thinks. I started off with that. Everyone thinks, but not everyone thinks correctly. The name of the discipline that is geared to correcting this problem of not thinking correctly is logic. Learning the rules of clear and correct reasoning is more than an academic exercise. For the Christian, it is also a means of spiritual service. I mentioned in the last class that in Romans 12, when Paul writes, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. He chose a specific word, the mind. And then in Matthew 22, where Jesus is answering the lawyer's trick question as to what is the greatest law, the greatest law that Jesus came out with was, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. So mind, cultivating a life of the mind is very important, or should be very important, in the life of a Christian. So that's the first point, guys. Why is logic important? But let's move on into, let's get a better handle as to the subject of what is logic. I gave you a brief definition, but let's dig in a little bit more. One definition that I saw here is, logic may be defined as the science that evaluates arguments. So, you can concentrate on that word science. You think of back in high school or middle school when you did science projects or you were part of science class and there was a very strict method that you had to follow. Same thing with logical thinking. You can consider it a science that evaluates arguments, and we'll get more into that. It's a tool, but it helps us arrive ultimately at truth. So when we use logical thinking, when we use the tools that are available in critical thinking, we have a better shot at arriving at truth. And so when we arrive at truth, hopefully we can acknowledge it and then say, okay, I understand it. I'm going to put myself under these truths and I'm going to follow them. And really, it's just a means of putting your thoughts in order. I mentioned that before. And the reason I say putting your thoughts in order is because we see order everywhere. Everywhere here on this planet, in this universe, there's order. In nature, you see the order of the planets, how they revolve around the sun. Very, very tight-knit. In art, we see beauty. But that beauty is coming out of the order that the painter, the artist, has put on the canvas. Also, in ethics, so the study of what is right and what is wrong, there's order there too. It's not just chaos. It's not everyone for themselves. We have built societies and cultures based around certain laws. And there's also certain laws that are distributed throughout the entire world that we know to be true. So there's order even in that. So then, now that we know that order is everywhere, I think it's plain to see that even in our thinking, there should be order. And that orderly thinking is called logical thinking. So a formal definition I'll give you here is logic is the study of right reason or valid inferences and the attending fallacies, formal and informal. So let's break that sentence down. Logic is the study of right reason. What I mean by right reason is the way to think so that we come to correct conclusions or truth, right? The way we way to think so that we come to correct conclusion, that is right reason. So logic is the study of right reason or valid inferences. Valid inferences means implications. So we want to know how to recognize when A implies B or when it does not, you know, when A implies B or when A does not imply B. We want to understand what are certain inferences that make sense so we can draw correct conclusions. And then the last one is the attending fallacies, formal and informal. Fallacies, as I mentioned, are mistakes in reasoning. They can be formal, which is the way you just set up your argument. The conclusion really doesn't follow. Or informal, there may be certain instances, and I would say this is a majority of the time when we go out evangelizing on the streets, you'll come across these informal fallacies. They're not even concerned with the way the argument's set up. They'll just bypass that, and they'll just say something that doesn't make sense at all, and it's not even relevant to the way the argument is set up. And that we'll study that next month. I'm really excited about that one. I think you guys will have fun with that. So if we want to break it down even more, just to sound bites, logic is the way to think so that we can come to correct conclusions by understanding implications and the mistakes people often make in thinking. So that is what logic is. Now we want to move on here. We're starting to get to the nitty-gritty, guys. All right, so here we're going to start learning some new terms. And as I mentioned before, anytime you have a question, just feel free to raise your hand and we'll get through it. But I want to move on to the first new concept that starts off logical thinking, and it's the three laws of logic. The three laws of logic. It should be there in your study guide. The three laws of logic have been defined like this. These fundamental laws are true principles governing reality and thought, and they are assumed by Scripture. They're fundamental laws. They govern reality. So there's three laws. The first law that you should see on your study guide, I believe, is the law of identity. The law of identity. This law of identity, the way to state it in simple terms, I guess, is A equals A. And I guess I could start writing on the board here. A equals A. A, or I'll say A is A, because that's the way we'll be talking today. A is A. In fact, let me move over here. Now, you're probably looking at me and you're saying, really, this is what I came to class for, to learn A is A? No duh genius, right? Noah, I see you. You're looking at me like that. I'm kidding. I guess another definition here would be a thing is what it is. Now, I know it sounds very simplistic and it sounds just super obvious, and it is. But this is one of the critical laws that we have to understand and really explicitly acknowledge. I think many of us have been assuming laws like these, but let's explicitly acknowledge it and understand it. A thing is what it is. Now, to better understand this, I think it would help to try to imagine what would happen if this law did not exist, or this law was not prescriptive, if you didn't have to follow this law. So imagine that A is A, but A could also, A is not A at the same time. So imagine I didn't have a law to really govern my thinking into determining something is what it is. What would happen is that I wouldn't even be able to speak. I wouldn't even be able to think. Because imagine I'm sitting in my bed and I'm holding a book. I'm reading a book. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm reading I can't even think about what the thing I'm holding is. Because this law wouldn't apply. A is A. Well, this book should be a book, but this law doesn't really matter. So this book could be anything. It could be a tiger. It could be a boat. You really can't think then. So then nothing would really have an identity. That's why this is so crucial. A is A. But another reason why it's crucial is that when you get in conversations, here's what an author wrote about this is, it is very useful for any conversation. It is essentially this. Make sure you are using your terms consistently. So when you're talking about Christianity and you're using terms to describe Christianity or the atonement or the Trinity or the incarnation or stuff like that, make sure you're using your terms consistently. You can't be talking about the atonement and you're totally off in left field talking about the Trinity. You know, the way you're describing it doesn't even make sense. Those two don't even line up. A is not A for you. So it's very useful in conversations. Make sure you're using your terms consistently, clearly, and correctly. A great many communication failures can be traced to the lack of clarity in the use of words or equivocating on their definitions. Always take time to clarify with people. What do you mean when you say, or make sure you are clear on what you mean as well. So the law of identity. A is A. A thing is what it is. Now we can move on to the second law of logic, which is the law of non-contradiction. The law of non-contradiction. The law of non-contradiction states that A cannot equal A and not A. Okay? A cannot equal A and not A at the same time and in the same sense. Not A, okay? Same time, same sense. Now, these last two phrases are what's crucial about this law. A cannot equal A and not A at the same time and in the same sense. This is a very intuitive law. If I make a claim about reality, then I'm also claiming that the opposite is false. So imagine if this law didn't apply. We go back to our first example. I could say that, let's use this example. Christianity versus Islam. Christianity states that Jesus Christ is God incarnate. That's my A phrase. Jesus Christ is God incarnate. Whereas in Islam theology, they say that Jesus Christ is not God incarnate. Well, because of the law of non-contradiction, both of these claims from each religion cannot be true at the same time and in the same sense. So Jesus Christ cannot be God incarnate and not be God incarnate at the same time. One of them has to give. They cannot both be true. I guess maybe a simpler example would be in my wallet. I could tell you I have $5 in my wallet. And then 3 minutes later, I tell you, oh, I don't have $5 in my wallet. You'd be scratching your head. What? What are you talking about? Yeah, I have $5 in my wallet and I don't have $5 in my wallet. Those two statements, those two claims cannot be true at the same time and in the same sense. Now, one of the ways that I can work my way around that law of non-contradiction is if I were to say, well, I have $5 in my wallet. I don't have $5 in my wallet. And then when I open my wallet, you see that I have I don't have five American dollars in my wallet, but I have five, you know, Canadian dollars. I don't know what they have over there. But I have five different kinds of dollars, right? So that's the same sense or in the same way I went around it. So at the same time, I did have five and I didn't have five, but I had it in a different sense. Okay? Same thing with Jesus Christ being God incarnate. People can find ways to wiggle around these rules because they will violate one of these two guys. But that's why it's really essential when you get in a conversation is to ask them, what do you mean when you say Jesus Christ is not God incarnate? They'll probably say some other time he was not or he was, or they'll say in the sense he was spiritually God incarnate, something like that. It doesn't make sense. So that's the law of non-contradiction. And then the last one, which is very similar, some people might get a little confused, but it's the law of excluded middle. Law of excluded middle. That one's a little simpler. It just says either A is true. Sorry, my R's are not good. Or false. And it kind of sounds like the law of contradiction, because I said with that one that both statements cannot be true. One of them has to give. This one says, look, law of non-contradiction says both can't be true, but this one says it's either one or the other. When I said one of them has to give, that's the law of excluded middle. So whenever, let's go back to the claim about Jesus Christ being God incarnate. Some maybe non-Muslim person may come up to you and say, well, maybe Jesus Christ was kind of God incarnate. That's not happening. It's either that he is God incarnate or that he's not. There's no middle ground. That's why it's called excluded middle. The middle option is excluded. It's either true or it's false. The same with any claim. Jesus' resurrection. God's existence. Either God exists or he does not exist. There is no middle ground. You can't have a kind of existence. It does not make sense. The law of excluded middle. It's either one or the other. As I mentioned right at the beginning, these laws of logic are unavoidable. They're undeniable. They're irresistible. I'm kidding. They're unavoidable. They're undeniable. And the reason I say that is because the very moment you start thinking, you're using logic. You may not be using it correctly, but you're trying to use laws of logic. And they're undeniable because whenever you try to deny one of the laws of logic, you have to assume these laws of logic. So whenever you say the law of non-contradiction is false, you're using the law of non-contradiction. You're using the law of identity to identify the law of non-contradiction. And then you're using the law of non-contradiction to say, well, both of these statements can't be true. They both can't be true at the same time in the same sense. And then you're using the law of excluded middle because you're saying, as soon as you say it's false, you're implying that the other one, there's only one other option. If I'm wrong, it's true. If they're wrong, it's false. So you have to assume the laws of logic. You cannot deny them. They are prescriptive. That's what I was mentioning before. They're just these attributes of nature that are governing reality. So it's not like the laws of physics, where the laws of physics like gravity, it just tells you what's happening out in the world, but it doesn't say that you should or have to obey it, you know? It's not like a duty. But with the laws of logic, they're prescriptive. They're telling you how you should think. They're telling you how good thinking should happen. So, for instance, that example, A cannot equal A and non-A. That cannot. It should not equal that. And, yeah, I already mentioned they're irrefutable. Okay, so those are the three laws of logic, guys. I want to take a pause here. Does anybody have any questions about those? Let me move this. Does anybody have any questions so far? All right, awesome. It's only going to get more exciting, guys. I promise. We got a field goal from Larry. All right, let's move on to the next section. We're going to move on to evaluating arguments. And as I mentioned, since logic is the process or science of evaluating arguments, then we actually want to know what an argument is. And again, this might sound even simplistic, but again, we want to work our way up. Let's see what an argument is. Well, often when we hear the word argument, we think of an emotional disagreement, you know, with our friends or our spouse or something. These are the kinds of arguments we want to avoid. This is not the kind of argument that we're talking about. When it comes to logic, there's a technical sense in which the word argument is being used. So in logic, when we talk about argument, we mean a group of statements, one or more of which are called premises, one or more of which are claimed to provide support for or reasons to believe one of the other statements, which is called a conclusion. So let me repeat that. It's a group of statements, first of all. One or more of which of these statements are claimed to provide support for one of the others, which is the conclusion. So let's break it down a little bit. little bit more. Sorry. Chuties is, is good. Group of statements. It's a statement that is either true or false. So whenever you're setting up an argument, whenever you make a statement, you're setting up statements that are true or false. So for instance, in your argument, you don't want to add questions. Those are neither true or false. You don't want to add imperative sentences, so just like commands or orders or something like that, like go make your room. That it's not neither true or false. It's just an order, a command. So you don't want to add sentences like those. You want to add declarative sentences that are can be either true or false. For instance, an example: broccoli is good for your health. That can be true or false depending on who you are, right? And then I mentioned two words here, premises and conclusion. There's two parts to every argument. First of all, we have the premises. These are the statements that are set forth to give reasons or evidence to support the conclusion. So this is where you do a lot of your work in the argument. This is where you set up good arguments that provide support or evidence or reasons to believe the conclusion that follows. Now, talking about the conclusion is a statement that the evidence is claimed to support or imply. It's claimed to follow from the premises, so we can make an inferential jump or an inference to our conclusion. And let me give an example here of a basic argument, and these are the kinds of arguments that we're going to be discussing mostly today. All crimes are violations of the law. I'll do a little bit of shorthand. All C crimes are violations of the law. Theft is a crime. Oh, let me write that. Big C. Theft is a crime. Therefore, I'm going to do a little triangle with the dots. That means therefore. Therefore, theft is a violation of the law. So these first two statements here, you can see they're declarative statements. They can be either true or false. All crimes are violations of the law. That's one statement. That's one premise in our argument. The second statement, which is also a premise, theft is a crime. So these two propositions or these two statements are setting up evidence or try to give you good reasons to believe what's coming after, which is the conclusion here. So this is my conclusion. And then these two guys are my premises. Does that make sense to everyone? So it's very basic. All crimes are violations. That's part of my evidence. Theft is a crime. That's another piece of evidence. You're like, yeah, I'm following you so far. Therefore, I can reasonably conclude that theft is a violation of the law. That's what a basic argument looks like. I have premises and I have conclusions, or one conclusion rather. There's some things to note about arguments. First of all, you have to have evidence. All right. If you don't have evidence to back up your claim, then you're just left with an opinion. So if I didn't have these two statements right here and I just said, hey, theft is a violation of the law. No. Prove it. Oh, I don't have any evidence. Well, that's just your opinion. That's the way that works. You have to have evidence to back up your claim. Also, you have to have a conclusion. If you don't have a conclusion, then you're just left with a bunch of data. You're like, all crimes are violations of the law. Theft is a crime. I'm not making a claim. I'm just telling you what my data is. Well, good for you. You go have your data. So you have to have a conclusion. Also, you have to make sure there's an inferential relationship between these two premises. You want to make sure that they're connected solidly and closely. They're closely associated so that it's reasonable to say after your premises, oh yeah, that conclusion makes sense. So you don't want to just have a bunch of unrelated premises and you're like, what? Your conclusion doesn't even follow from those premises. Okay? This is, I think, we sometimes fail a lot in this area. So you want to think hard about what's my evidence to support my conclusion? You want to make sure there's a close-knit relationship between the premises. Also, and this goes without saying, you want to make sure that your premises are true. This goes a long way, guys. You can't just say, you know, start talking about evidence, but it winds up not being true. You know, it may make sense in your mind. You're like, yeah, I can draw a conclusion. And sometimes it happens. And we'll look at the kinds of arguments and we'll see how you can draw true conclusions, but from false premises. It happens. But that's why I say it's important to make sure that the evidence that you have for your conclusion, make sure that your premises are true. All right? All right, so that covers what an argument is. Does anybody have any questions about that? All right, let's move on. There's two kinds of arguments, at least two kinds of arguments that are normally used in logical thinking. I know of at least one more, and I'll just mention it, but the two kinds that we're going to concentrate on these next two classes are deductive arguments and inductive arguments. The third one that I'll just mention the name is abductive. We won't go through that, but I think in later classes, especially when we get into the evidence for resurrection for Jesus, we'll get into abductive reasoning. But the two kinds that we're going to concentrate on these next two classes are deductive and inductive. Well, let's check out what they mean. Deductive arguments or deductive reasoning are arguments that attempt to provide certainly true conclusions. Certainly true conclusions. So, for instance, this is a deductive argument here. Because you notice that my conclusion necessarily follows from my premises. When you look at it, you're like, yeah, it makes sense. It is certain that theft is a violation of the law based on my two premises here. So you want there's certain conclusions. And typically you notice in deductive arguments that they argue generally from the general or the universal to the particular. So check this out here. This is a deductive argument. All crimes are violations of the law. So you're noticing a general statement. It covers a broad range. All crimes are violations of the law. And it moves down into the particular. Your conclusion is actually talking about a very specific case. Theft is a violation of the law. You moved from all to a very specific case. So it argues from the general to the particular, to the specific. Deductive reasoning starts with the cause and it reasons to the effect. So in our normal day-to-day lives, there's cause and effect. The cause comes before the effect. So this is trying to reason going forward. Okay, I have a cause. What will the effect be if this is a cause? That's the way it's reasoning. And here's a quote here. Argument, a deductive argument in which the premises are claimed to support the conclusion in such a way that it is impossible for the premises to be true and the conclusion false. So if you set up your argument correctly and your premises are both true, then your conclusion has to be true. It is impossible for your conclusions to both be true, and if it's set up correctly, and then your conclusion false. That is impossible. So that's why we say it reasons to a certainly true conclusion. So that's deductive reasoning. In inductive reasoning, I'll go ahead and erase this so this won't confuse anybody. Inductive reasoning is kind of it's pretty much the opposite here. Inductive arguments attempt to provide probably true conclusions. And the way that happens is when you argue from the particular to the general. And one argument that I heard that I thought was pretty good is, say you start arguing like this. Well, Hitler was a dictator and he did a lot of evil things. Mussolini was a dictator and he did a lot of evil things. Mao Zedong was a dictator. He did a lot of evil things. So I'm starting with very particular cases. And then my conclusion would be, therefore, the next dictator will probably do a lot of evil things. So I made a general statement as my conclusion. And notice it was probably true. Because I had my premises were all particular. And then I think, it stands to reason that the next dictator will probably do evil things. So from the particular or the specific to the general. It starts with the effect and it argues for the cause. It goes backwards than a deductive argument. This is the majority of the knowledge. This is the majority of the reasoning that we do on a day-to-day basis, because obviously we don't have all the knowledge. Sometimes we're fortunate enough, even in deductive arguments, we have to really dig down to finding how our premises are true. Yes?
So inductive is basically assumption.
I guess elaborate on that. What do you mean?
Because since you're with your argument, you assume one dictator does this is evil, then you assume the next one will be bad too.
Yeah, I guess it is sort of an assumption, but it's based on prior reasoning.
Assumption based on fact, kind of.
Yeah, you're trying to make a jump in...
You're making a more of a general, not even a generalization, but more of an informed assumption?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I would want to refine the word assumption. I probably wouldn't use the word assumption. It's an inferential...
Yeah.
It's an inference.
Yeah.
So I look at what the effect is. Mm-hmm. So let's come up with another example. I go to the grocery store and the first 5 oranges that I pick up are all rotten. Mm-hmm. And in my thinking, okay, orange 1 was rotten, orange 2, all the way to 5 was rotten. Mm-hmm. My thinking now, inductively, is orange number 6 will probably be rotten. Mm-hmm. That's an inductive. I looked at the effects, mm-hmm. and I'm arguing back to a cause. Mm-hmm. So I'm going from the particular to the general. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I could probably say this whole box of oranges is probably rotten if I have enough evidence. Okay, but you know what? I'll say this: we're going to get into inductive reasoning very in depth next class. So we can actually look at all the different steps, the different requirements, I think, of what it takes to make a good inductive argument. Okay. But for now, I would say...
To avoid an assumption.
Yeah, avoid the word assumption. It's just an inference based on what I've seen so far in a particular sense, in a specific sense.
But they're both inferences. It's just one inferencing a cause and one inferencing
the effect. Yes. Yes, both are inferences, but yeah... One's reasoning forward, one's reasoning backwards. All right, any more questions, guys? Good question, Cody. All right, well, as I mentioned, tonight we're actually going to be concentrating on the deductive reasoning. And I got to say, guys, there's quite a lot to know. Like I mentioned, there's going to be a lot of terms we're gonna learn, but don't fret. We'll walk through it very nicely. A lot of them are very easy to understand, easy to memorize. And... I did want to mention this about deductive, is that there are various arguments for and against God that are deductive in nature. That's why I believe learning how to argue deductively is very important, because there's some very crucial arguments that are in the frame of the deductive argument. So I think it'll be helpful to learn the basics of deductive arguments. And then also, when you go home, hopefully after, you know, learning about deductive reasoning, you can go home, you know, read a book, look at the TV, listen on the radio, listen to what claims are being made, even in the commercials, especially in the commercials, because they're trying to sell you a product. They're trying to draw you to a conclusion. So then now you can work your way. What is the conclusion? What are the premises here? Do they make sense? Are they reasonable? Are the premises true? All right. Well, let's start off, guys, with deductive arguments. And first, we want to start off with a new word. It's called syllogism. Syllogism. When it comes to deductive arguments, one form of an argument is called a syllogism. There can also be arguments from definition or argument from mathematics, but the one we want to use is a syllogism. The example that we just had on the board about crime being a violation and all that, that was a deductive argument. It was a syllogism. A syllogism, you ask, thank you for asking, is a type of argument containing exactly 2 premises and 1 conclusion, just like we showed on the board. Remember our example, right? All crimes are violations of the law. Theft is a crime. Therefore, theft is a violation of the law. We had 2 premises and 1 conclusion. Now, within syllogistic reasoning or syllogisms, there's 3 kinds of syllogisms that we can learn or concentrate on. The first one is a hypothetical syllogism, or it's also known as a conditional syllogism. A hypothetical or a conditional syllogism is when you reason like this. If this, then that. You're placing a condition. If this condition is true, then this will happen. That's the way you reason conditionally or hypothetically. The second kind of syllogism that you will learn is disjunctive. Disjunctive. The way this reasoning works is either this or that. So either this happens or that happens. Either this is true or that is true. Disjunctive. All right. The last one is called categorical. So we have categorical syllogisms, and this is the one we're going to start off with. A categorical syllogism is like this, is like the example we had. This is that. So all crimes are violations of the law. I'm putting crimes into a category of violations of the law. That's the way a categorical syllogism works. It works with putting things into categories. We do a lot of this, especially when we go to the grocery store. You know, when you look at your fruits, you have your oranges, you have your apples, you have your bananas or whatever. You're putting all these into different categories. So whenever you walk up and down the aisles, you think to yourself, okay, I'm going to go to the produce section. That's a category. Then I'm going to go to the dairy section. Maybe not a lot of us in here. Not anymore. But we think in categories. It's very natural for us. So we're very familiar with this. So this is why I want to start off with categorical syllogisms. I did want to mention something about validity and soundness. You should see this on your study guide. Validity and soundness. What does this mean? Well, it's very crucial to understand that even if you have your argument set up correctly, as I mentioned before, it does not necessarily guarantee that your argument is going to be true. Remember I said your premises have to be true and your argument has to be set up correctly. So those two conditions have to be met in order for you to have a true conclusion. When it comes to the case that when only your argument is set up correctly, so even if your premises are not true, but your argument seems to flow, that is called a valid argument. That is called validity. It's just the way your argument is set up. It doesn't have to do with the truth or falseness of the premises. It just says my argument is set up correctly, and assuming my premises are true, my conclusion does follow. But it has nothing to do with whether or not they are actually true or false. That's validity. A sound argument is what we want to reach, is what we want to work for. A sound argument is a true. It has a true conclusion. And those two conditions are, to have a sound argument is that your argument has to be set up correctly, has to have a correct form, and your premises have to be true. So I know I've used this a lot in just arguing with different people. A lot of people will be like, that's not valid. I'm like, you're not using the word valid correctly. You know, just say it's false or something. You know, I think my argument is valid and I can show you blah, blah, blah. That's just, you know, being a little anal at that point. But so there's difference between validity and soundness. And sound arguments are what we want to work towards. All right, we can move on now to start looking at categorical statements and syllogisms. Okay, I want to write one example on the board and then we can break it down. I think you should have an argument, right? It says all men are mortal. It starts off like that. All men are mortal. This is like the classic example given in all textbooks. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. So we have our categorical syllogism. we have our two premises and our conclusion here. But I want to concentrate on just the two premises here. They're called propositions also. A proposition is just a declarative statement. That's all it is. Okay, and what I want to say about a categorical proposition, so remember, it's putting men into a category of mortals. It's putting Socrates into a category of man. The thing about these is that every categorical proposition contains a subject and a predicate. So now we're actually going back, way back into middle school, probably in your English class, learning about subjects, verbs, nouns, predicates, whatever. But every categorical proposition has a subject and a predicate. So let's talk about subject a little bit here. Subject inside a categorical proposition is the thing or thought about which the assertion is made. It's the thing about which the proposition is about. A subject, I think we're all familiar with this. It's usually a noun, person, place, or thing, or idea. So here, who can tell me what is the subject here in this first line? What is the subject? Men, yes. So I'm going to put a little S above here. You guys can, you know, feel free to write whatever notes you need to make sense of this. Here's our subject in this categorical proposition. Yeah, in our example, the subject would be men. We are talking about men in this categorical proposition. Now, when it comes to the predicate is that which is asserted about the subject term. So it's the thing we're talking about the subject. So here, what would be our predicate in this first statement? Mortal, right? So what we're saying about men is that they are mortal. It's the thing that is about the subject. And the subject is the whole thing that is what we're talking about. So subject and predicate. Very simple, but it'll become very crucial. So subject men, a predicate mortal. Now you notice that we still have these two words left over. What do we do with those things, okay? Well, there's two more words to define here. The first one is copula. Copula. And I thought it funny because Bungie actually used that in his sermon today when he was talking about the word and being a copulative relationship or whatever. And I was like, where did that come from? Like, I don't know, Bungie say that in my life. Anyways, there's copula and then there's quantifier. Now, you can already start guessing what quantifier is and start looking at that and see which one it is. But let me start off with copula. A copula is defined as that which joins the subject and predicate terms. So what is it? Is that which joins the subject and predicate terms. So who can tell me what is the copula here in our first statement? What joins the subject and the predicate? R, right? So we have our copula here. It joins. All men are mortal. And it typically has, you'll see those types of words. So the copula usually takes the form of is or is not, are or are not, will or will be or will not be. That type of language will always be what the copula is. And then we turn our attention to the quantifier. And obviously it's the last one left here, and you can tell already that the root word has to deal with the quantity, the amount, or the extent of something. And here it usually deals with the subject. So the quantifier is usually associated with the subject. So keywords will be like all, none, or some. So here is our quantifier. All men are mortal. We could also say no men are mortal or some men are mortal. These would all be quantifiers. And believe it or not, you know, there's some examples from the Bible. I think I wrote them down in the study guide. Isaiah 40, verse 6 says, all flesh is grass. Look at that. Isaiah's a logician. And then in 1 Corinthians 6, Paul, who I definitely believe was a great philosophy student, he said, no fornicators or idolaters or adulterers or homosexuals shall inherit the kingdom of God. So he's making a categorical statement. No, these type of people will be in the kingdom of God. So he had the quantifier, subject, copula, and the predicate all in there. It's very basic. So those are just a couple of examples, and there's plenty to look throughout in the scriptures, guys. And in general, they will follow this pattern. Okay, so get used to this pattern in a categorical proposition. Are there any questions so far? Make sense so far? Okay. Let's talk about the copula and the quantifier a bit more. I want to talk about two more terms. The first one, they're both Q words. The first one is quality. Quality. The quality of a statement or a categorical proposition occurs or changes when you change the copula. So we are changing the quality of the statement when we change this word. And it makes sense, because there's a big difference when you say all men are mortal and all men are not mortal. Whenever you change this copula, this word here, the quality of the statement changes. So it happens when you change the copula. And a statement can either be qualitatively positive or negative. Remember those words, positive or negative. And so you saw how I said either are or are not, is or is not, will be or will not be. Those are ways that you can change the quality of a statement. The tense doesn't matter. It's whether it's positive or negative. Examples in scriptures would be like, all men are sinners. Are, that's a positive one. I think these should be on your study guide. God is not a man. That's a negative statement. What about these two, these last two that are written there? God is non-man. What do you guys think? Is that positive or negative? God is non-man.
Positive.
Positive. You're right. Are you positive? God is non-man. Because non-man, you see how the hyphen there, it connects those two? So he's saying positively, God belongs to the category of non-man. Positive statement. What about this last one? No circles are squares. Positive or negative? No circles are squares. Sounds difficult, right? It's a little tricky. You think it's positive? Who says it's positive? Who says it's negative? Who doesn't want to be in this class right now? This is actually a negative statement. The way you can restate it, it's different because you see the word no, but then you see the word are, and you think it automatically that copula is positive. But whenever you see the word no in front, that usually indicates that it's a negative statement. You can restate it like this. All circles are not squares. It's just a different way of saying that. But it's because we don't usually talk in that kind of language, so it makes more sense to say no circles are squares. So it's still a negative statement. And an easy way to remember this is no and not are negatives. So whenever you see no in front or not in the copula, it's a negative statement. So that's quality. We want to move on now to quantity. We talked about the quantifier there in the beginning. It changes the extent or the amount of what we're talking about when we look at the subject. So it includes words like all, some, or none. And whenever we change this quantifier, we can make a statement either universal or particular. Universal or particular. So universal would be when we use exaggerated words like all or no or none, something like that. It doesn't mean that it applies to the whole universe, but it applies to the category that is defined by the subject. So it's saying everyone within the category of men. That's what it's talking about. So it's applying only to the category of the subject. All right, let's get that. So that's a universal. Now, when we talk about particular, so when we use words like some or not all, we're talking about specific instances. So it can be a whole wide range of people, but it, you can just be missing one and it would still be some. But so it's always at least one of the category or everything except one. Anything that is not all. All right. I hope I didn't stumble over my words and confuse you guys. But that is particular. It always includes at least one in the category. Examples of this, changing the quantifier or the quantity of the statement would be all men have sinned. None is righteous. No, not one. Or when Jesus told the parable of the seed, some seed was scattered among the weeds. That's changing the quantity. All right. Now, moving on to the next section there, it talks about four types of propositions. And the reason it's four is because, remember, we have two ways in which we can change a statement. We can either change the quantifier or the quality of the statement. And each one, you can change it two ways, right? So you either have a universal statement or a particular statement. Or you can have a positive statement or a negative statement. These have to deal with the quantity. That probably doesn't make sense because they're both Q's. You can either deal with the quantity or the quality of a statement. So guess what? I have four possible combinations of how to make a statement. Four types of propositions. So here, it should be here on your notes. I can either have a universal positive statement here in this first box. I can either have a particular positive statement, or I can have a universal negative or a particular negative. So we can go through each of them and talk about how they're actually set up. And there's actually little mnemonics. They use the vowels of the alphabet. So there's type A, E, I, and O. Type A is a universal positive or affirmative. And the way you write that one is all A is P. All A is P. Or actually, let me change that A to an S to avoid confusion. So the subject and the predicate, that's what it should stand for. All S, so it's universal and it's positive. Does that make sense? So that's type A, universal positive. The second type, type E, is universal negative. Universal negative. So universal, I still have my all. S, negative, what do you think it should be? Oh, actually, that's wrong, right? We don't talk like that. So it's no S is P. Thank you for not answering. No S is P. That's a universal negative. So we're trying to use natural language here. That's type E. Type I would be a particular positive. Particular positive. So in particular, you use the word some. This is on your study guide, so I'm like, you guys should know this. Some S is P. Some S is P. That's our particular, and this is our positive copula. The last one is a particular negative. So here, and get this is a little different, right? Some S is not P. When you're talking about some, when you're talking about particulars in natural language, it just makes more sense to talk about it this way. Some S is not P. So these are the four different types of categorical propositions that we will ever look at. There are no other types. These are it, because there's four total combinations, okay? So good thing, four is a small number, so you can memorize these. And that's why we put A, E, I, O. If you want to draw this little box to help you out, that'll be fine too. But the reason this is crucial is because it's just a form of shorthand. So whenever somebody may, or you may hear something on the media or something, And, oh, that sounds like a universal positive statement. Okay? And the reason this is important to just quickly memorize these is talking about our next section, which is distribution. Okay? But before we get to distribution, are there any questions about these four types? Does it make sense to everybody? Okay. So let's talk about distribution. And we'll take a little break here in a minute, but I want to get through distribution at least. Here's another concept. So when you're dealing with categorical propositions, it's important to know when you are talking about all of a category and when we are only talking about part of a category. I think that makes sense, right? That changes the whole thing if you're talking about all of something or some of something. It affects our conclusion. And so when it comes to distribution, a term like all S, that's a term. Is P, that's a term. A term is said to be distributed when it refers to all of the members of its class. A term is said to be distributed when it refers to all members of its class. For the subjects, it's pretty straightforward, right? Our S's right here. Because they all have the quantifiers in front of them. And also, just for your information, if there's no quantifier in front of the subject, it's assumed to be all. Okay? So if it just says S is P, you just assume it's all S is P. But for the subjects, I'm saying is it's easy to tell when those are distributed or not. So here, all S, is that distributed? Because it refers to all of its class. It's distributed. But what about the predicates? How can we tell if these are distributed? How do we tell if the categorical proposition is talking about all of the members of this predicate here? That's a little bit more difficult, but it's actually not too, because there's some pretty straightforward rules here. Well, let's start with this example here. This should be on your study guide in John 3:16. There's a categorical proposition by Jesus. Whoever believes in him will not perish. Whoever believes in him will not perish. So the subject is all who believe. Whoever believes. All who believe. And then the predicate. So we know that that subject is distributed, right? All who believe. Then the predicate implies that all who believe will be among those people who do not perish. So do you get that? They'll be among, just among the people in the category of those who will not perish. And I think it helps to draw circles, especially when talking about categories. It'll really help us understand what we're talking about. So we have our big circle of the pool of people who will not perish, right? We have a big circle of people who will not perish. I'll put NP, not perishing people. Jesus is saying, whoever believes in him will not perish, will be among the people who will not perish. So I can actually draw a circle here. Whoever believes, or Warner Brothers, or some, whatever you want to say about that. WB, whoever believes will be among the people who will not perish. So he's not talking about everybody who's not perishing is whoever believes. He's actually leaving room, you know, there could be other people that are not perishing. But that's the way it works out logically. That's not what we're saying is actually the case. But the way it's set up is that they will be among these people. So we see a little circle within the bigger circle. That's the way to make sense to know if the predicate is being distributed or not. So, where was I here? Ah. So it helps to draw circles. This is helpful. It'll become helpful to know that we know when we can know the distribution of the predicate based on the distribution of the subject. So as soon as you see, okay, the subject is distributed, you'll automatically know what the predicate is, distributed or undistributed. So let's talk about some basic rules here. And that's where we bring back the four types of statements, A, E, I, O. So let's start with type A. Type A is all S is P. So let's bring up an example here. All horses are four-legged animals. All horses are four-legged animals. Here we have four-legged animals. Big old pool of four-legged animals. And then it's saying that all horses, every animal that belongs to the category of horses, is among the category of four-legged animals, right? So I have horses. All horses are four-legged animals. This is type A. It's a universal positive statement. So you notice that the subject is distributed, obviously, because it has the word all right in front of it. And it could be restated like this. All horses are a part of the class of four-legged animals. So the predicate then is not distributed. The predicate is undistributed. Because this H is not the size of the 4LA circle, right? So the predicate, the four-legged animals category, is not being taken up. It's not referring to the entire class of four-legged animals. So we call that being undistributed. So for a type A statement, a universal positive statement, the subject is distributed and the predicate is not distributed. For type E statements, no S is P. So an example would be, no horses are two-legged animals. So we have our big circle of two-legged animals. Think of all the two-legged animals that could be out there. No horses are part of this category. So then we have our circle, our H circle out here. The entire class, a unit. So this is a universal negative. No horses are two-legged animals. So it's outside the circle. So that means it's being restricted from the entire category of two-legged animals. So then our predicate, two-legged animals, is distributed because it's referring to the entire category. So the subject is distributed and the predicate is also distributed. So let's move on to the type I statement here. Some S is P. This is a particular positive statement. Some S is P. So we can say some horses are white. So I have two more circles. Well, I have some horses are white. You know, I could be out here or something. You know? Now, is the predicate referring to all white things or some? Well, look at here. This circle is not taking up the entire W circle. I'm not referring to the entire class of white things. Think of all the other animals that are white. Polar bears, that's all really I could come up with at the moment, but there's plenty of other white animals. An albino squirrel, I don't know. I've seen them. So when we have a particular positive statement, the subject is obviously undistributed. But then also the predicate is undistributed because it's not referring to the entire category in the predicate. So the last proposition here, some S is not P. We have a universal negative statement. You should be catching on by now. What do you think? The subject is obviously undistributed. What about the predicate? Some S is not P. What do you think the predicate is?
Distributed.
Yes. Some S is not P. Just like with the horses being two-legged animals, some S is not P. It's restricting it from the entire category. And the big picture here, guys, is an easy way to memorize, you know, which predicates are distributed and subjects are distributed and undistributed is by remembering a simple mnemonic. Unprepared students never pass. Unprepared has a U, so universal, S for subject, and then N, negative, P, predicate. So whenever you have a universal subject, these guys are distributed. But then when you have a negative predicate, they'll be distributed as well. So if you want to know which ones are distributed, just remember that mnemonic. Unprepared students never pass. And this will definitely help when evaluating some deductive arguments. As I mentioned, there's some critical arguments for the existence of God that are deductive in nature. So it's gonna pay off to tell whether the predicates or the subjects are distributed or not. Because I'll tell you what, I was listening to a debate recently, and one of the atheists, you know, debating, he's basically against philosophy or logic. And he said, the reason I am is because you can make anything true. And so he brought up this weird syllogism, and he didn't distribute correctly, and everybody was just laughing at him on the internet. It was ridiculous. He's crying out against logic, but obviously he can't even use it himself to defeat his opponent. You know what I'm saying? So it becomes critical. So that may happen to you, where somebody tries to bring up an argument against you, but they're not really distributing the subject or the predicate well enough. And so their argument fails. Okay, so we just finished talking about the four types of statements and also the distribution of the subject and the predicate. But now we want to actually talk about syllogisms. So before all this, we were talking about just categorical propositions. So just the premises, right, individually. But now we want to look at the syllogism as a whole. And a syllogism is it has three propositions, the two premises and a conclusion. So if I want to write the popular syllogism, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Let's write that back up. I'm going to write all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is a mortal. Okay, as we mentioned, there's two premises and a conclusion, and this will help right away in identifying whether an argument is valid or not. So obviously, if it doesn't have, you know, two premises and a conclusion, there can be no argument. Remember validity. Even if the argument is set up correctly, it does not guarantee that your conclusion will be true. You have to have true premises to have a sound argument. But now I want to bring up three more terms that we want to learn. They're called the major term, minor term, and the middle term. The major term is defined as the predicate of the conclusion. So we talked about subjects and predicates. We look at the conclusion. It's the predicate of the conclusion. What is the predicate of this conclusion? So, therefore, Socrates is immortal. What is the predicate?
Mortal,
right? Here's our predicate. Therefore, our subject would be?
Socrates,
right? Our major term is the predicate of the conclusion. So when we talk about our major term, it belongs in a premise, and wherever this major term is located, that premise is called the major premise. So mortal, we look up here, it's in our first premises. I should really write this out. Is a man mortal? Wherever we find mortal, that's our major premise. So here is our major premise, and then then we talk about our minor term. The minor term is the subject of the conclusion, which we already defined to be Socrates. So wherever we find Socrates in the premise, that's our minor premise. So we have major term, minor term, major premise, minor premise. And then we have our middle term. So we did mention subject, predicate. We have most of them covered. Which subject or predicate or word did we not cover? Which one's missing?
Men,
right? Men and individual instance of men, right? So that's our middle term. The middle term is shared by both premises, but you will not find it in the conclusion. The middle term is shared by both premises, but not in the conclusion. This is what gives us our inferential jump. This is what gives us our reason to say, oh yeah, therefore I can say this. That's what the middle term's job is to make a connection between the two premises. Therefore, I can make a logical jump to the conclusion. That's my middle term. So just remember, main thing is it's shared by both premises. So those are the three terms that we want to learn about a syllogism. But now we want to turn our attention to six rules of how to form a valid syllogism. There's six rules that we want to know about how to form a valid syllogism. They're easy to remember and they're very intuitive. Okay? So let's start with the first one. This should be on your study guide. The first one is, there must only be three terms. I mentioned this right at the outset. There must only be three terms. And three terms, not three propositions. This is talking about terms. So remember I mentioned a little bit earlier, I'm not sure if you remember, but all men is a term. Mortal is a term. Socrates is a term. And this is my middle term, so it's really only one term, right? So I have one term, two terms, three terms. These are shared, so it doesn't count. One, two, three. I don't have four, I don't have two, I don't have five, I have three terms. A valid syllogism must have only three terms. Whenever you get in a case where it's invalid, it's usually when a term has been equivocated. Equivocation happens, and this happens a lot, is when you use a certain term differently. You have a different definition for that term in both premises. So let's just say, for the sake of argument, here, all men, you're talking about mankind, right? That's really what he's talking about. All mankind is mortal. What if here Socrates is a man? He actually meant the gender. That's a different definition than what we were using here. If that were the case, then this syllogism would be invalid. Because now, instead of three terms, since this guy is defined differently, it's actually a fourth term. So I've just invalidated my syllogism, okay? Because I've equivocated one of the terms. And that happens a lot. Okay. Also, sometimes some people will make this syllogism invalid by somehow sneaking the middle term into the conclusion. That makes it invalid. So if you ever see one of the terms that is shared by both premises, but then all of a sudden you see it here in the conclusion, no go. Bad. Bad form of reasoning. Bad dog. How about an example here? It should be in your study guide. There's a syllogism there. All inspired writing are included in the scriptures. Handel was inspired when he wrote the Messiah. Therefore, Handel's Messiah should be included in the scriptures. The example itself?
Yeah.
Okay. So just hear me out. Thank you for telling me.
So which part of the
syllogism?
Well, it's not there.
Yeah, I'm going to write it. So all
no,
in...
That's a serious question.
No, yeah, well, I'll write it and then we'll go through it, right? All inspired writings are included, I'll just say are in Scripture, big S. Handel was inspired when he wrote Messiah. Therefore, Handel's Messiah should be included in Scripture. In S. So, we're talking about there must only be three terms. Let's count the terms here. All inspired writings. That's our first term, right? What's our second one? It's going right to, or left to right. What's that?
Scripture.
What's our third term? Handle, right? Well, remember, there's a major term and a minor term, and then there's a middle term. What's our middle term here? Inspired, right? Because it's shared by both premises. So this seems to be our middle term. But does the conclusion follow? Should we have Handel's Messiah because he was inspired? Should we have that in the scripture? What just happened here? Remember I talked about the reasons sometimes why inspired was equivocated, right? Here we're talking about the way the scriptures use the word inspired. When Paul wrote to Timothy, all scripture is inspired, it literally means God breathed. He's talking about a very specific definition. Here, Handel was just psychologically in an excited state. I'm inspired. I just ate a granola bar or something. I don't know. And I'm going to write an awesome piece. That's a different kind of inspiration. So here, it's equivocation. There's two different definitions. So in fact, we have four terms, and it's invalid. So that is an example of an invalid syllogism. Okay, second rule is the middle term must be distributed at least once. Remember we talked about distribution? The middle term must be distributed at least once. So the conclusion tells us how the two premises are related to each other with respect to the middle term. And if the middle term doesn't refer to all of its category at least once, there might not be any relation at all between the two premises. Now, I don't know, is there an example there?
No. Oh,
totally didn't even write the examples. Shame on me. Well, for the sake of time, I will speak them, and hopefully we can work through this. The example is this. The first premise is all Baptists, maybe you can write it down in abbreviated form. All Baptists are baptized. So right away we notice that the subject is distributed, and the predicate is, this is a universal positive, so it's not distributed. The predicate is not. Then the second premise is all Presbyterians are baptized. That's the same kind of proposition, right? Universal affirmative or positive. So we have a distributed subject and undistributed predicate. The conclusion, therefore, all Presbyterians are Baptists. The conclusion is also a universal positive. Well, what is our middle term here? All Baptists are baptized. All Presbyterians are baptized. What's the middle term? What's being shared between the two premises? Baptized, right? That's the term that is being shared by both premises. And we're talking about the rule that the middle term has to be distributed at least in one of the premises. But as we showed that both of them are a certain particular form of a proposition where baptized is the predicate and the predicate is undistributed. And therefore we have a conclusion that does not follow. It's an invalid syllogism. So it helps to draw out squares, right? So we have all Baptists are part of the category of people who have been baptized, right? So we have the big old circle of people who have been baptized, with a D at the end. And then we have this circle, all Baptists are baptized. Then our second premise is all Presbyterians are part of the category of baptized. So here, I have Presbyterians. But then the conclusion says all Presbyterians are Baptists. That doesn't mean, no. Because the middle term was not distributed. It could be possible, but it just doesn't necessarily follow from the argument. That's what we're talking about. So when in doubt, Draw a circle, see if it makes sense. Okay. The third rule. Terms distributed in the conclusion must be distributed in the premises. When you have a term distributed in the conclusion, referring to all of the category, then you'll have to find it also distributed in the premises. The kind of concept here is you can't take more than what you have in what you put in, right? So if you don't have it distributed in the premises, you can't have it refer to all of the category all of a sudden in the conclusion. An example here would be, and I'll talk slowly so you guys can maybe write it down if you want. The example would be, all Hindus are vegetarians. All Hindus are vegetarians. That's a type A proposition. So you can see which one's distributed and which one's not. No Jehovah's Witness is a Hindu. No Jehovah's Witness is a Hindu. Therefore, no Jehovah's Witness is a vegetarian. Does that make sense? So what type is the first premise? All Hindus are vegetarians. That's a universal positive. So we have a distributed subject, but an undistributed predicate. No Jehovah's Witness is a Hindu. Well, we have a distributed universal negative, right? So both, or the predicate would be distributed here. No Jehovah's Witness is part of the entire category of Hindus. Therefore, no Jehovah's Witness is part of the category of the whole category of vegetarian. So we see that the conclusion here is distributed, right? The distributed predicate, vegetarian. But in the first premise, vegetarian was not distributed. So where did that come from? Now, if you draw the circles, try to do that on your own, you'll see that, oh yeah, nothing follows from this. The circles don't match up because it was undistributed in the premise and all of a sudden it was distributed in the conclusion. You can't have that. Can't take out more than what you put in. The fourth rule is the conclusion always follows the weaker premise. What I mean by that is if one of the premises is particular, meaning it's not universal, so it has indicators like some or not all, then the conclusion must also be particular. And the concept behind this is you're only as strong as your weakest link. So if any of your propositions are particular, then the conclusion will also be particular. If your weakest proposition is a negative, then your conclusion is also going to be a negative. You're only as strong as your weakest link. So here's a syllogism example. No wicked person will escape judgment. This is a universal negative. No wicked person will escape judgment. Second premise, some Americans are wicked. There's an undistributed subject. It's a particular affirmative. The conclusion, therefore, has to be a particular negative because we had a negative in the first premise and then we had a particular in the second premise. Therefore, some Americans will not escape judgment. And that makes sense. So conclusion always follows the weaker premise. The fifth argument here, or rule rather, for creating a valid categorical syllogism, no conclusion follows from two negative premises. No conclusion follows from two negative premises. If nothing from one group has nothing in common with another group, then you can't say anything about the two groups. You know, that they don't share anything in common. You can't say anything or about any relationship between the two. For example, no humans are angels. So we can draw this one out. We have our big circle of angels. No humans are angels. Well, I have my humans circle out here. It doesn't refer to angels, right? The second premise is no angels are God. So we have another God circle out here. So they're all disconnected. There's no relationship between them. Because therefore, what would be the case? Nothing. There's really no relationship here that I can draw, that I can infer. So no conclusion will follow if you have two negative premises. And the last rule here is no negative conclusion follows from two affirmative premises. No negative conclusion follows if you have two positive or affirmative premises. So you've ever heard two wrongs don't make a right? This is kind of the opposite of that. Two rights will not make a wrong. All right? Jesus said, let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. Same thing applies to logic. If you have a yes, yes in the premises, you got to have a yes in the conclusion. All right? You cannot say yes, yes in the premises and then have a no in the conclusion. An example would be, all members of the Trinity are fully God. All members of the Trinity are fully God. Second premise, some members of the Trinity take orders from God the Father. Some members of the Trinity take orders from God the Father. Therefore, not all members of the Trinity are equal to God the Father. How does that work? Well, let's see. All members of the Trinity are fully God. All members of the Trinity are fully God. Then you have some members of the Trinity. Some members of the Trinity take orders from God the Father. So you have some members of the Trinity take orders from God the Father. This is some members of the Trinity. What circle did I draw first? All members of the Trinity are fully God. Some members of the Trinity take orders from God the Father. I'm trying to remember how to draw my circles here. Yes, I always draw blanks. Sorry. Not all members. They belong to a category that take orders from God the Father. I would say there's a... I can't even bother drawing it. Sorry, I drew a blank.
Third circle's inside the small circle.
That's what I was... Yeah.
And it can't be inside the big circle.
Yeah.
And the small circle.
What was the third statement?
So the conclusion would be that not all members of the Trinity are equal to God the Father. But we had two affirmative conclusions, but then somehow that... the conclusion was a negative, and it shouldn't be.
So the circle's supposed to be with some members of the Trinity, like within it, but it can't be inside the bigger.
There you go. Okay. This little guy right there?
Yeah.
There we have a little circle within the members of the Trinity, because some
be
of them.
Within the bigger one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's not possible to draw it.
Yeah. Well... I can draw the circles. It's just that the conclusion was wrong.
Oh, okay.
That's what I'm saying, is the conclusion has to be positive. Yeah. The conclusion would be, therefore, some members of the Trinity obey God the Father. That's all we have, right? Some members of the Trinity are fully God, rather. Sorry. That's the conclusion. But here, the wrong conclusion was that not all members of the Trinity are equal to God the Father. And the reason I bring that up is because you'll have Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons kind of use this reasoning with you. Oh, well, the reason that you don't have a Trinitarian setup is because, look, one of them was obeying the other, and they're not fully God at that point. So you can see here how the syllogism is not valid. All right. So that covers the six rules of how to create a valid categorical syllogism. And you know what? I think we'll stop there, guys. There's some more on your papers. We'll cover those in the next classroom session. And it goes over the hypothetical syllogisms and also the disjunctive syllogisms. There's really not too much to learn there. There's just some basic parts, you know, names of the parts of the argument. But you can create some really cool deductive arguments using those types of syllogisms. But we'll cover that in the next class, guys. I'm sorry this ran long. I underestimated how much we had to learn, but Again, guys, when you try to fit it, you know, in one class, something that it will take quite a while to learn, you know, that's just what we run up against.